Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Lapide CISO Talks. Today, we're joined by Bob Turner, CISO in residence and co-founder at Cyber Hero VC CISO Network, a platform that brings together cybersecurity professionals, fosters knowledge sharing, and encourages open discussions. Bob, welcome to the show, and I'll go with your team's motto, let's have some fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's one of our core values is to have fun.
Excellent. Yeah, well, it's a real pleasure to have you on the show. And I'm really keen to sort of get started with a little bit about your Cyber Hero origin story, so to speak, going with the theme. Tell us where you got started and how you ended up where you are today.
Well, you know, I have to blame my dad for part of this. My dad got me really interested in technology and in the days of ham radio, single sideband radio and stuff. And it was just such a thrill to be up in the Pacific Northwest in Spokane, Washington, and talk to somebody in Florida. And it sounded just like they were next door. You know, and so from there, I joined the military. I was in the Navy. I was in the submarine force as a radio man, oddly enough. In that, I learned a lot about networking and communications and just the technology that went into it. And mind you, this was in the 1970s. So the technology's evolved quite a bit since then. But I also got opportunities during my career, which included a couple of submarine tours, teaching at the submarine school, and then I got to go to the surface Navy. In the surface Navy, it was all the ship's communications, and that included the embark staff, were up to me to make sure it worked. And that was kind of one of my first experiences at trying to modernize. In other words, let's reduce the amount of paper messaging that was going on and try to get things delivered electronically. And I carried that actually through the rest of my military career. I kept going to the organizations that were either right on the cusp of or just needed a push over the edge to do that kind of thing. But it was also as networks were really maturing. I mean, we started networking command and control systems on board ships. We started, you know, being able to instantaneously exchange information with the shore stations and the shore commands organizations. So my last two tours in the Navy where I did the unthinkable. I actually had them getting messages on their desktops.
Wow.
So that was kind of fun. Those two organizations were the Allied Command Atlantic in Norfolk, and then all of the Navy communications inside the Pentagon. So two big jobs for a young sailor, and they were a lot of fun. I decided after 23 years it was time to retire and go, you know, seek my fortunes elsewhere. And I got into cybersecurity sort of at the right time. We were starting to think about how were we going to manage risk and how were we going to transition small networks into larger enterprise networks. And it really became a good time to be there because there was a lot of theory being discussed at the time. But there was also, you know, just that never ending stream of things that were going on. And back then it was, you know, sort of the infancy of cyber attacks and they were not really very sophisticated. They didn't have to be because we just weren't ready for it. But as we started growing through the 2000s into the 2010s and now we're into the 2020 world, it's a big deal because we found out that the cyber adversaries are smarter than we are in a lot of cases. So in that, I've begun to really appreciate what I call the three pillars of any successful cybersecurity organization. That's the people, the processes, and the tools that you use. And I weigh a lot on the people because it really doesn't take a lot to be successful in cybersecurity. I think you just have to be curious. And if you're curious enough, you're going to find things out and you're going to find better ways to do things. And, you know, curiosity is equally balanced between adversary and the people on the right side. That's kind of my origin story for being in cybersecurity. Now, we decided last fall to form a company that provided the small to medium sized businesses with the availability of really highly talented and greatly experienced and vetted cybersecurity professionals, virtual CISOs. And that's where we're at right now is sort of we're still in the forming stage of building the company and the platform and all of that kind of stuff that goes around it. But I think we're going to be really successful here in the very near future as we transition from the prep stage through the building stage and into the serving the customer stage.
Yeah, certainly. I've read a few articles from your LinkedIn profile, and there is a lot from your team and you know, the advocacy of virtual CISOs and how you know, it's so important for those small and medium-sized enterprises to have availability to expertise such as that, which is great. But a lot to unpack there. You know, love the thing about the three pillars and your ethos about, you know, staying curious. I suppose that also kind of ties in with your background in education and, you know, encouraging future generations of cybersecurity professionals, but also protecting important data within educational institutions.
Yeah, there are so many opportunities to mentor not only the up and coming cyber professionals, but it's also helping the leadership and you know, the people of key responsibilities within an organization understand that, you know, cybersecurity is not something to be feared or to run away from. It is actually something to embrace and be able to do business better. I think about the small to medium sized businesses, which is really that vulnerable market. Large businesses have, you know, data backups, they have alternate data centers, they have the cloud, they have all of this stuff going. But the average small business, what are they going to do if they lose access to their data or they lose access to their information systems? I mean, that's kind of the death knell for a lot of them. And I have, you know, a great appreciation for that, because really what we have, what we're building is a small business. And frankly, it would be devastating if we lost our way to connect with customers, you know. And if you talk to just about the attacks that are going on now, 61% of small to medium businesses were hit by some sort of a successful cyber attack in the past year. Whether that's just simply a ransomware attack, as devastating as a ransomware attack, or as simple as, you know, a phishing expedition that caused them to give away, you know, some sort of a specific credential that is necessary. 61% were hit by a successful attack, you know, and I guess the kind of the corollary to that is, how much data was really lost? And when you think about data, you think first and foremost, the average human says, that's my personal data. What happened to that? Well, you know, there's been somewhere in the neighborhood of almost 400 million total victims over the past couple of years. You know, that's a lot of people. That's a lot of people to be involved in that. And it doesn't show signs of stopping is the big problem. We got to get a better handle on it. We got to get our arms around being able to protect the data and keep the business operational. That's where I like the term resilience.
That's it. Yeah, we see that that term come up a lot. You know, being resilient. You know, what does it take to build that resilience in the face of, you know, these threat actors and you know, the targets being the small and medium-sized enterprises, which, you know, in fairness, is a good point because, you know, it's a lot easier to blanket attack some lesser resilient SMBs than it is to go after like a big fish where they have that resilience and all the measures in place. So, yeah, it's kind of just a mass attack by those threat actors. So, going with the resilience theme, you know, what would you say it takes in this day and age and with the current threat landscape for an SMB to be resilient, as it were?
Well, I think it's a number of things, and it's things you really need to be able to know in advance. You know, what are the core functions of your business? What are the, you know, the crown jewels of your data? And also, how do you minimize the impact of attacks on that data to your operations? You know, there's also a couple other things you need to be thinking about. You have stakeholders. Every business has a stakeholder somewhere, right? And you also have a business reputation. Look at the major ones that have gone down, and let's just go back, 5 or 10 years. We've got Target, we've got Anthem, we've got Colonial Pipeline. We've got, just a whole bunch of examples to follow, and that's without going into some of the recent ones, which are, just really egregious. How do you minimize the impact on the operations and still maintain your reputation? It's not a single tool or a process. Resilience really needs a combination of, multiple strategies, multiple technologies, multiple processes, and of course, people that understand, people that are willing to go and find out what would happen if, and then fill in the blank after that, right? Success, your resilience when you can anticipate, withstand, and adapt to the various risks and challenges that are out there.
I see. Yeah. And would you say that, various frameworks and structures play an important role in that? NIST 2.0 really kind of
the great thing about this version of the NIST cybersecurity framework is they really kind of wrap all of those other important components inside of governance, and I as I have been playing with the cybersecurity framework for a number of years now, it occurred to me that there ought to be some way of, making sure that this can be performed, plan, do, check, act, that kind of thing is still important no matter where you are. But I really have to applaud the initial framework. If you can identify the things that are in your information enterprise, if you can then protect those things, then the fun comes afterwards. But I'll maintain that if you invest well in identification and protection, then when you get to the respond and recover phases of the cybersecurity framework, you're going to spend a lot less. You're going to spend a lot less time. You're going to spend have a lot less anguish, and you're not going to hydro test your people on a regular basis in order to keep things going. And it really is just making sure that you're looking at those key variables, the things that are important in cyber resilience.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a story we tell, well, at least that I tell every day when I'm speaking to clients on behalf of Lapide is, when you're beginning on that journey, you need to identify, where are those critical assets, not to mention the risk, the fallout from losing them, the reputational damage, the operational downtime, but, just getting a handle on, where is your sensitive data, why it's sensitive, what compliances does it fall under, and then looking at, what does my environment look like? Is everything locked down? Are there overprivileged users? And, what is the posture looking like? So before you get into the, real-time detection and then response elements as well. So definitely it is a journey, but it's nice to see that, the NIST 2 revamp has been launched, I think, end of February, wasn't it?
Yes.
And certainly a decent framework.
You can hear the trumpets blaring?
you certainly do on LinkedIn. It's all over the feed, and I just read the too long to read versions.
It's also whatever you're doing, if CSF 2.0 is your framework for addressing resilience, it's great, but don't forget that there's important things you have to do along the way. So first of all, you have to decide what resilience really is. As a CISO in education, I said the two most important factors I need to know are the mean time to detect the anomaly, the weirdness, the attack, and in the meantime to remediate. If you can have those as key metrics and you are working with them, obviously you want both of them to be as low as possible, but you really want to have that remediate as close to detect as possible. So it really shorten up the time to get from fire engine to fires out. And right after fires out should be, you know, the system is back online and it's functioning normally, and you've been able to test the preventive measures you have in place, and they are all still working. That becomes one of those real important things. And so I guess if you order them, it's, how fast can you detect and respond? But also, how fast can those preventive measures that you implement following the attack be seen as working?
Yeah, excellent. And obviously, the vCISO Cyber Hero Network is still in its infancy. But you know, what is the kind of the purpose and the mission that you set out to achieve when you started it? You know, as a co-founder with your other founders, you know, what is that, and you know, what are you looking to achieve, both from a kind of education standpoint, but also bringing those CISO capabilities or vCISO capabilities to the masses?
Well, so we're intentionally thinking about that small to medium business or enterprise market. So if you think of rural healthcare organizations, maybe they're not part of a large conglomerate, but they have a hospital with thousands of patients and a lot of data, right? The healthcare industry has been one of the most targeted for cyber attacks, you know, in compared to, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, the number of data compromise incidents are almost double where they were from 21 to 22-ish timeframe. And that's, you know, we're talking about the beginning of the end of COVID. And now we're talking about, you know, we're post-COVID by a couple of years. Those are still important organizations, and they, you know, they get hacked. In fact, I just this past week, I opened a letter from a healthcare organization I've been associated with. And I said, "Hey, we're sorry to tell you, we lost your data." Yes. And that's not a fun letter to read, especially when, you know, you've been in the business for a while, and it really bodes the question, you know, if we can't protect that kind of data routinely, then maybe there's some different choices we should be making on how we collect the data, how we manage the data, how long we keep the data, what is the real relevant data that they need to just do the day-to-day operations in healthcare. Is that better on, you know, more securable devices that can be portable? Or is that in a large cloud data center somewhere? And if they're protecting that data, are they protecting it wherever it's accessed? You know, and let's face it, people are human. They're going to say, "Oh, let me just dial in on my phone and get this little piece of data real quick." You know, and so they're connecting to a data source that has potentially my data.
Yes.
and they're kind of exposing it to whoever's close about. You know, we haven't figured out that part of the security enough at scale and at a reasonable cost in order to be, you know, sort of arrogant with our data.
Yeah, it is certainly concerning when you see those letters or those emails saying, you know, millions of customer PII was lost in this mm-hmm. breach. And, you know, for some people, it's not a concern because they think, well, you know, I'm not that important. You know, my data's out there anyway. You know, what do I care? But certainly, even if a ransomware, for example, is not paid, you know, which is usually an attacker's primary goal, then, you know, it gets sold on the black market, doesn't it? And but really, you know, you really want to avoid that reputational damage and operational mm-hmm. downtime, which, you know, to a lot of organizations can be life-threatening, and, you know, some don't recover from it, do they? So, yeah.
And that plays to the recover part of the NIST framework. I mean, if you're focusing on the front end, great, you're doing the right thing. But you have to keep that interest and that action going throughout the entire cycle.
Right.
And that goes for any of the cyclical activities that we do in cybersecurity, risk management and compliance. You know, you identify the system, you do a real good vulnerability check, you do a nice little pen test, and then you say, okay, it's good. And if you just leave it alone, how long does it remain good? So you've got to have that cycle. You have to keep going back. And if you think about it system by system, it's daunting. So you need to zoom out just a little bit and say, what are the common things that we can do for the entire organization that will be effective at the system level and at the data level and at the, you know, the operational technology level?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, compliance is obviously a big one. And correct me if I'm wrong, I remember hearing that is it something like one HIPAA record is a $10,000 fine per record or something like that?
Yeah, I think that varies, and kind of assigning a dollar value, I think, is the wrong question to ask.
Right.
You really need to say, what is the total risk impact? It's not just dollars and cents. It's my data. You know, what else could somebody do if they knew about medical conditions? What else could they do if they knew what my bank account balance was? What else could people do if they knew, you know, the value of the home that my wife and I own?
They usually try and sell you something, don't they?
Yeah, they usually do. And those are fun phone calls because there's a little button that has a little red thing on the bottom of my phone. I just press that and I don't have to have that conversation anymore. But the value is out there. So, tax records are sort of public knowledge, right? Not only that, but all the real estate companies that are trying to ask you if you want to sell your house, they know a value of your house, whether it's the accurate value or not, really doesn't matter. That value is out there, and it doesn't take a lot of averaging to figure out what the real value is of the property you own. So, and you hear the commercials on TV all the time, they're hacking your deed, you know, and they get kind of monotonous because they're saying that for an hour over and over again. But it's true, you know, that your home ownership can be manipulated, your credit rating can be manipulated, and a lot of things can be manipulated just by knowing a little bit about you.
Or just old school sort of, people getting scammed, you know, the more a person, especially the elderly, you know, if, these records, this data is out there, you know, you've got scam artists calling people up and making it sound like they're from a legitimate company and then extorting money from, somebody who doesn't know better because they sound legitimate.
Awareness is important. And for a lot of organizations in the past, what I've done is I've kind of held the, if you get this phone call, what do you do kind of sessions with people just to help them understand a little bit more. But it's also being self-aware of who you're talking to and what you're talking about. That's kind of that core human security tool that every business needs. So I love the latest commercial I saw where the person at the console is saying, "Oh, my cat's names are my passwords." and the cat's sitting on the person's lap, and then all of a sudden the little alarm goes off. You've been hacked. we got to be better at that. But it's also, let's face it, it's hard to remember a whole bunch of passwords. So how do you do that? You know, what is the tool that you can put in place to help you manage multiple accounts, multiple passwords? Ask anybody in cybersecurity. If you are an administrator of any kind, you've got so many passwords, you just can't remember them all. And you can't. You really shouldn't use the same ones over and over again, right? That's another one of those nice little rules. But it's also how much information you share in your social media and how you build your credentialing. I'm a big fan of the multi-factor authentication that is going on at the banking level. So, you know, number one, you have to have my phone in your hand, or you have to have cloned my phone somehow. It could happen, but you also have to know. What I know, you have to know what my magic words are, and no abracadabra is not one of my passwords.
yeah, certainly. And how is the network actually growing? I mean, is there a kind of official number of virtual CISOs that you have on record that you kind of position to various organizations?
So we have a handful. I'm not going to tell you the exact number, but fine. we are about to be pressing forward with not only recruiting virtual CISOs, but also sizing up clients that that fit the mold and clients that we know that we can make a difference in. And we're also, you know, at a point down the road, hopefully not too far down in the future, we're just going to have a way that they can dial into our website, you know, click on a link, and then they'll go to our platform. And in that platform, that's where we're going to match up the skills of the CISO with the needs of the client. And that will make it so that we put the right person there to do the right work for them. In a lot of those cases, it's just going to be, you know, a fraction of a CISO. The term fractional CISO is really popular these days, because not everybody needs a full-time, you know, 100% CISO. They need somebody to get them through a few projects. So getting an incident response plan together is not a trivial matter, but it's also making sure that they can do those basic things like identify what their assets are, make sure those assets are protected, and then operate those assets on a regular basis in a vulnerable world, in a world where the threats are constantly changing, and in a world where it becomes almost easier to just take a deep breath and step back for a few minutes, and then some more clarity comes in, and then you can start working again. Sometimes that clarity comes through a vulnerability that visits itself, and you actually are out. That's the wrong kind of relaxing. I don't find it very valuable at all. But just thinking ahead and running through that process, continually understanding, you know, what the data is, where the data is supposed to be, how that data is protected, but also what information systems can access that, where can they access it from? Do you deploy VPNs with your portable mobile devices? Do you use that in your personal life too? And is there a separation between the two? And that has to be really important to understand from a business perspective as well as a personal perspective.
And I'm assuming because of the fractional nature of the involvement of the VC, so with these enterprises, it must come with a slightly more manageable price tag.
It does. It, 100% of a CISO's salary and 401k plans and medical and dental and all of those things that go with it, not to mention the payroll taxes, that can be quite daunting. And if you're just paying a flat rate fee, maybe even just by number of hours on a particular project, you're going to come out a lot better at the end. And most of the folks that we see doing the CISO work, the virtual CISO work, some of them are doing it because they just want to keep in the game. Some of them are doing it so they can change industries, maybe upskill and go from banking and finance to utilities and power distribution, or maybe even explore education, which, by the way, is a place that really needs the help of a CISO in a lot of cases, because it's just a place where there's not a lot of money. The great thing is that there is a lot of organizations out there, and if I could, you know, mention one of them right now, is the K-12 Security Information Exchange, that really watches out over that environment. You know, the primary and secondary schools, and they're working with, you know, folks in places of responsibility to try to get legislation passed that will provide more resources and more assets, and then the question after that is, do we have enough professionals to fulfill that need when it becomes funded? And are those professionals flexible enough to be able to move between the different facets of education and normal industry and banking and finance or healthcare or utilities? You know, some of those critical infrastructure, key resource components that the U.S. Department of State, Department of Homeland Security has identified. And really, it all comes down to the end of the day, are we doing the right thing to make sure that these businesses are resilient? And it's inevitable, you know, as long as people are breathing, hackers are going to be hacking.
Yeah, and I remember from our previous quick intro call, you mentioned those 16 sort of key infrastructure verticals, quite a few that we have mentioned on the talk today. And certainly there's them, and then there's the supporting supply Lovely. Chain as well, where there's also an element of risk. So yeah, certainly it's a lot goes into the bigger picture, as it were.
I was privileged to listen to a presentation by a very smart person who's at one of those Washington think tanks, and his quote was, "We built one of the most interconnected economies without paying attention to cybersecurity, with the that proper undergirding of cybersecurity." So we can make an economy work. We just have to make it work securely. And I really think that that's part of our role in the Cyber Heroes vCISO network, is to help those small to medium sized businesses and enterprises be competitive in the arms race that is cybersecurity nowadays.
Fantastic. I think that's a really nice sort of macro high level note to end on. Thank you very much, Bob. It was fantastic to have you on the show.
Well, thank you very much. And I do thank you for the opportunity, and let's get cyber going.
Yeah. Good luck with your vCISO journey. And I'm sure you'll go from strength to strength in the future.
Yes. It's going to be a fun ride.